You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And today we've got interviews with poet Kevin Crossley Holland and editor of New York offline magazine, Lauren Trimble. And my studio guest is author and illustrator Gillian McClure. Hello, Gillian.
Hello.
So, author and illustrator, which way round do you prefer it?
I think I'm completely down the middle. When I'm with authors, I don't feel 100% an author. And when I'm with illustrators, I don't feel 100% an illustrator. So I come together very much in the picture book format.
And which way round does it work in terms of when you're putting a book together?
The first draft is usually written. And then I put the pictures with the images and I try to interrelate the two. And that's then the second draft of the text, because I can remove words that then appear in the images.
And the images, the illustrations are beautiful. Do they take longer than the words?
Yes. Yes, now I'm finding the illustrations more arduous than the words, yes.
And tell me what happens to the illustrations after they've been in the book, because they are works of art. Where do they go?
Well, they're piling up in my house. I do take them into schools. I do a lot of school visits and show them in schools and libraries and when I give talks. But one day I will have to sell them, I think. Oh. Some of them actually are in the Seven Stories archive. So I did donate some, but I've got a lot at home.
Because I often do think that illustrations in books are underrated as works of art, because they are absolutely beautiful. And presumably when you're doing them, you're treating them as a work of art.
Yes, yes. Obviously, they've got to work with the text, but quite a lot of them are what's called a double-page spread, which is a picture that spreads right across the two pages of a picture book. And they make rather good pictures when framed.
Oh, well, let me know when you're selling them. I'll come back and give you a proper introduction in just a moment, but we're going to listen to your first piece of music that you've chosen, which is Can't Buy Me Love. Why have you chosen this?
Because when I was little, we lived up a lane called Mouse Lane, and I went to school at Horsham High School, and the girls there were all very trendy, and they dragged me off to see the Beatles in Brighton, and I wore a pair of stockings with sewn black beetles on them.
And did you scream?
We screamed so badly that I was deaf for a week afterwards.
Can you even remember what they sounded like? Or did you...
I remember the screaming more, but it was terribly exciting.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's listen to it now. That's Can't Buy Me Love by the Beatles, the first choice of my studio guest today, Gillian McClure. Gillian's career as an author and illustrator spans three decades. Her books have been translated into many different languages, and Selkie, published by Random House, won the US Parents Guide to Children's Media Award for Outstanding Achievement in Children's Books. And her recent book, Flood, has been nominated for this year's Kate Greenaway Medal. Congratulations, Gillian.
Thank you.
How important are those kind of awards and recognition to you?
Yes, it's good. And one of my earlier books, actually, that I did with my father, Tog the River, was highly commended in the Kate Greenaway Award in the 1980s. And I think Selkie was longlisted. So sort of been there before. But it's nice that...
Because your father, Paul Coltman, you collaborated with him and he was a poet.
Yes.
Did he influence you then in your choice of career?
Not really, except that with a love of literature and reading. Yes, perhaps he did, because I did illustrate some of his poems very early on as a teenager.
And I suppose he just showed you that actually it's a possibility to have a career in literature and art.
Yes, except as a child, I felt I was never going to grow up, so I didn't think about it too hard.
And have you always, I mean, you're talking there about working with your dad, have you always had that urge to be an artist?
Yes, I did it all my childhood, and I made up stories for my sisters and illustrated them. And as I said, we lived in this rather remote place up Mouse Lane, and we were quite sort of isolated, no TV, and I was ill a lot with ear, nose and throat things. So I just had to fall back on my imagination and amuse myself with my own stories.
So how did you make the leap from amusing yourself with your own stories to becoming a published author and illustrator?
I taught just for 3 years up in Scotland. I taught reception class, and in those days we were teaching them to read in the initial teaching alphabet, and there weren't very many. It's a phonic alphabet. There weren't many books written in that alphabet. So I made a homemade book called The Emperor's Singing Bird, and I bound it and illustrated it and had it in my classroom in the book corner. And a school's inspector came in, spotted it, and he had an interest in publishing, and he sent it off to a publisher, and it was eventually published by André Deutsch, but not in the initial teaching alphabet. So that was my first book in 1974.
So that was how it all started, really, a school inspector happening to see something that you'd done.
And then afterwards, I did do some black and white illustrations for an educational book of his too.
So when you're going to school now, because you were talking earlier on about your school visits, that must be a kind of warm memory, bring back more memories for you, does it?
Yes, it seems very unreal, and I'm not sure that that's a way that people could start nowadays. It's become much more competitive, the whole industry.
And you were talking earlier about the relationship between text and illustration. How would you describe that relationship in a children's book?
I think it's very important. I think it also brings in typographic design too. So you've got these three strands all feeding into the narrative and the dynamic and the rhythm of the book. And my more recent picture books, I've had less text because then it's much tighter integration of word and image and typeface.
And how much do you leave to the children's imagination? How much do you spell out through the illustrations?
I always have visual subplots that I hope the children are going to discover, and these will work on their imaginations. So I have a visual subplot running through a text that isn't spelt out in the actual text.
So would the illustration echo the text, or does it pull the child further forward into this in the story, into the plot, if you like?
Yes, it elaborates the text. It adds to the text.
And I know that a lot of what you've done has been inspired by fairy tales.
Yes.
What is it about fairy tales that you like?
I think what I like about fairy tales is that they often have a slightly dark side. And I think all my books probably have had that. And as a child, the books I liked had that slight darkness to them. So not exactly cosy, sweet books. And fairy tales, I like the idea there's an underlying emotion and that you tap into this emotion, though it's not actually spelt out.
And you presumably tap into it through words and pictures.
Yes, I try to draw out this feeling that runs through the book. And if one is successful, then it's got greater levels to it than, you know, a more surface book.
And I suppose fairy tales, they also have the basic plots for every story that you ever want as well, don't they? You know,
yes.
Romanced, separated children.
Yes, yes. But these all go back to sort of basic emotions like loss. And that was the emotion in my Selkie book, because the friendship, the human, the little boy, loses the Selkie seal at the end when she puts her skin back on and returns to the seals in the sea. So, but children, I've discovered when I go into schools, all know this feeling, loss, whether it's a bit of lost Lego or, you know, a more profound loss. They know it.
I love the Selkie myths. For people who don't know, they tend to be around the north of Scotland, really, in the islands, don't they? They're seals who turn into young women or young women and men when they come onto land, and then when the sun rises, they put their seal skins back on and go into the water.
Yes, my Selkie is a little girl, and it's a friendship with a boy. So, yes.
Oh, lovely. Mm. Now, we've got an interview coming up with Kevin Crossley Holland. You were telling me that actually you'd illustrated a book by him.
Yes. In 1993, we did The North Myths. And I did the illustrations, and this was for, they were quite a gift series done by Simon and Schuster. And I loved working with his words. They were very, very, they really sparked my imagination, but dark. And my illustrations are quite dark too.
Well, myths and fairy tales, they're sort of out of the same pot almost,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes.
Well, Kevin Crossley Holland, indeed, he's a poet and a children's author. The Seeing Stone won the Guardian Children's Fiction Award and the Smarties Prize Bronze Medal and has been translated into 25 languages. He's translated Beowulf from the Anglo-Saxon and retold Norse myths, as we've heard, and British folk tales. I spoke to him on the phone at the end of last year and asked him what it was exactly about folk tales and myths that inspired him.
I wonder how much of whatever appeals and inspires any of us has to do with our childhoods. My dad used to come and sit by my sister's bunk bed with his little Welsh harp, and he said and sang stories to us, folk stories from before I can remember. And so I suppose the first hoard, the first fund of stories I really got to know was not off the page, but hearing him sing and say them. But then when I revisited them as I began to write, they are so non-digressive. They go straight from A to Z. They don't deal in psychology. They just move straight on, and the meaning and quality of the story is revealed through the action rather than through some writer commenting on how someone is bad or someone is good. Also, the language of the folk is always simple, always clean, always quick, always clear. And as a writer, whether for children or adults, that's always seemed to me desirable. Perhaps because I love the Anglo-Saxon language, and on the whole, the words in our language that come from that root rather than from Latin are the good, quick, clean, sharp, bright words to do with the stuff of life, like womb, man, woman, earth, sea, ship, fire. And why should a writer not try to take the short way home? And one finds that in folk tales and myths.
So do you think they're actually embedded in us much deeper than we realise sometimes?
Well, I do, because I think myths, on the one hand, define where we stand in relation to our collective memory and collective beliefs. They deal with our spiritual longings. Folk tales deal with the human comedy, and they are absurd, funny, touching, sometimes tragic, but they deal with humans in relation to one another. So, of course, they show us ourselves in a dramatized form, and that presumably is why centuries, generations and centuries past, they don't lose their popularity.
And do you think it's because we're learning something from them still, even though we know them very well, each time we look at them afresh, we see something a little different and take away something different?
It's very strange the way in which you listen to a story or look at a story and you come back to it 5 or 10 or 15 years later and you see something else in it. One shouldn't mistake the clarity and simplicity of the language of a folktale for facility. It actually embodies real understandings about human behavior, the way in which people get paid their just resorts, the way in which the truth will out, the way in which loyalty rewards itself, and so on. So I think that it's a bit like a prism, really, a really good folktale, I suppose, and more profoundly, a myth. It gives us back different sides of itself and therefore of ourselves.
And do they still surprise you?
I think they do, because there are still twists of action. There's still figures who are sort of yeast in the pudding of the story or the body of legends who cause things to change. And that's very unpredictable. That's the very nature of it. Otherwise, the story would be predictable before you begin. But there are times when when you're really shocked by a turn of action, especially where tricksters are involved.
And talking specifically about the Arthur trilogy that you've written, obviously that's such a massive story and one that a lot of us feel very familiar with. How did you choose to approach it so that it would feel different for you and for the reader?
Well, I think really that question, how did I approach it so that I found it new for myself? That's the crucial thing. And maybe especially in an area as heavily worked as the Arthurian legends. But as many of your listeners will know, there are actually Arthurian legends all over the shop in the Middle Ages in at least 11 different medieval languages. So the first thing was to read and read and read and read. But what I did was look for a kind of an antiphon, which I would alternate between the life of a 12, 13-year-old Arthur de Caldecott, who is growing up and is beset by the usual problems of being one of a family and being one of a very small community and hoping for one thing but fearing that something else will happen and all the anxieties you associate with beginning to be a teenager and so on. And I tried to balance those stories against the stories that I found inside Arthurian legend that somehow echoed his growing up on the edge of adolescence, on the edge of England and Wales, at the crossing place between two centuries, 12th and 13th centuries. Of course, I needed the foundation legends, like the Sword in the Stone, or how Merlin advises Arthur, or the installation of the Round Table and the knights. So to some extent, my choices were made for me, because I wanted to tell the full body of the Arthurian legends. But at the same time, I wanted the specific legends I chose quite often to reflect or anticipate my young hero's changes of mind and heart. Yes, I knew where I was going, but talk about surprises. Quite often there was something that completely took me aback as I was reading through canons of Arthurian legends I had never read before and that fitted wonderfully, and I'd never come across them until that minute.
So when you planned it, did you end up where you think you would?
I think I knew it was going to be a story of Arthur's childhood, a story of the rise of Camelot, and a story of the fall of Camelot. But the absolutely fascinating thing was to pit my young Arthur de Caldecott, an idealist young boy, eager to read, hoping to be a squire, wanting to go on the Crusades. I realized the more I read into the Arthurian legends, for instance, some of the stories of betrayal and conflict, that violence is glorified, that brutality is matter of course, that there are atrocities, and they turn Arthur's stomach. And it was only through getting to know my young Arthur through 2, 3, 4 years that I began to understand how he'd react in different circumstances. And when he's there on crusades, the sort of glory and trumpets of war were in juxtaposition with him seeing a little boy, for instance, caught up and put into a sling and chucked right over the walls of a city. And he begins to see individual violence of the kind that we witness all around us today. Not that that was in my mind, but these things have a way of echoing themselves. So, of course, like any decent novel, it begins to take the reins of its own power away from the author and to suggest to the author what will happen next.
But given that your readership is a young adult readership, you had to tread very carefully around those subjects, presumably.
Primarily, I suppose it is. And it's sort of 13, 14, 15. But I've always felt that my readership, in fact, know that my readership, perhaps 1 in 5, 1 in 4 or 5 is adult, because I hope there are enough ideas in the books. But then comes the question of what is appropriate to a young adult audience. And I think the answer is quite a long way, because you look around at the last Carnegie Medal winners and so on, and there is more or less the full gamut of human experience in the 21st century and in centuries before therein, other than incest, which remains pretty much a taboo subject. There's very little else we could think of that doesn't turn up in children's books, and I suppose the reason for this is, or books for young adults, that kids know all too well about these things. So that in the Arthur trilogy, sure, there's a murder in the family. Sure, there's a picture of the atrocity of war. Sure, there are pictures of infidelity and so on. But provided the book has Lee some kind of moral center, which is not to say the author is breathing down your neck, saying this is right and this is wrong, and of the awakening of an intelligent, feeling boy to the world around him, then I think that's how it should be.
And there is something obviously clearly compelling about those Arthurian stories to children today.
It's not hurt by the fact that so many kids are involved in role-playing games, sword and sorcery fantasy stuff, but actually the sheer brilliance of the individual stories of loyalties and betrayals and conflicts and love and out-and-out passion, of great good and great evil, but also of the sort of unpredictable catalyst, rather like Loki in the Norse mythology. And one of my books is The Penguin Book of Norse Myths. So also in the Arthur trilogy, it's Merlin and various other magicians, Morgan Le Fay and so on, but essentially Merlin, means that it's an unpredictable, changeable set of circumstances. You do not know how it's going to turn out quite often as a reader or as an author. I think all of that adds up to a stupendous body of stories which have at their heart a dream that we really could do better than we do, that there could be a golden age represented by there having once been a golden age. That's how Maori saw it in the Middle Ages, that there was once a Middle Age and a golden age, and now things have gone to the devil. I think it is that dream, that sense of purpose. Children respond very powerfully to prejudice and to injustice, don't they? And that's there in spades in this trilogy, as in many fine children's books.
And just on a practical level, Kevin, for you, because you write poetry and prose, do you write them at the same time? How do you juggle them?
Yes, juggle's the right word. A sort of the work of an amateur juggler. The other day I was giving a talk and I was introduced as an amateur juggler because someone took literally what I said. On the whole, I have several things on the go because I write reviews and I'm president of the School Library Association. But there comes a minutely when you know that the pace is quickening and things are intensifying and you've got to concentrate for a while on the one or the other. I've been bringing for the last few months a new book of poems together called The Breaking Hour. And they have to do with the sort of themes that you now have in the Cambridge Festival of Ideas. Identity and memory and belief systems and family and continuities and discontinuities. And there's a moment when you focus so much on that that you need to let go of most other things for a while. And it's certainly true also with winning momentum to write a longer novel.
And is it always obvious to you what form an idea should take, whether it's prose or poetry?
Not quite. In fact, sometimes, the question, I've been writing rather weird mix of the two. Almost narrative adult poems, which are coming out as prose poems of a kind. Not a very fashionable genre, but what the heck. It just seems appropriate for a number of things I've been addressing recently.
That was poet and children's author Kevin Crossley-Holland. Kevin, talking there, Gillian McClure, about the brutality that's in some of these myths. And it's true, isn't it? And in fairy tales as well, there are abandoned children, children treated badly. How do you deal with that when you're trying to put that on the page for a child?
Well, I'm writing for a much younger age group. The picture book age group really goes from when you start reading to children, a year, 2 years, up until perhaps 7, 8, when they move on to, as it were, chapter books. So the brutality, obviously, isn't so extreme. But as I said, there is a slight darkness there that younger children, you know, can tune into and find they respond to within themselves.
And I suppose because you're doing words and pictures, you can put, if it's too hard to go in words, you can convey it through pictures or vice versa.
Yes. Maybe the image in my book, The Flood, of the hen caught in the fox's tail as they find themselves in the flood. And she thinks it's a nice furry nest, but we know that the fox has been trying to eat her. But of course he now can't, because he himself is clinging on to another tail. Well, a young child will get a bit of a frisson from that, knowing, you know, what the fox is really up to.
And when you came up with that image, You must have been very pleased, because that's
I was. I kept very quiet about it because I hadn't seen it anywhere else. A lot of what we do has been done before, obviously. So I did keep very, very quiet about that image. Though I had been working with children at Wisbeach St Mary's in a residency, and we'd been working on the floods, the Fen floods, and we created a story around this image, and then an artist, John Wiltshire, helped the children do a wonderful stained glass window which hangs in the school hall of these animals in the flood, except in that picture it's a duck and not a hen.
And how does an image come to you like that? Does it, you know, do you wake up thinking, wow, that's great, or is it trial and error?
Well, that one just literally dropped into my head. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, well, lovely, wonderful image. Well, we're going to listen to your second piece of music now, which is The Lark Ascending. Why did you choose this?
Well, it's played in this piece by Jean Pounier, who used to lead the London Philharmonic in the war years, and he actually was my violin teacher. That makes me sound as though I'm a brilliant violinist, but actually it's a sad story for Jean Pounier, because my mother wanted me to learn the violin, and I was terribly ashamed of carrying the violin to school for my lessons when all my Beatles-loving friends, you know, were just thinking about the Beatles. So when there was a chance of having the local peripatetic violin teacher come to the house all the way up Mouse Lane, I was very relieved. But when he walked in the door, my mother... she realised it was Jean Pounier, and she was a huge fan of his. So it was a very awkward situation, because I wasn't very good. I really wasn't very good. And he taught me all through my teenage years. Whenever I got onto the E string, he said I was skinning the cat again. And I'm sure my mother was hovering outside the door, poor thing. But the way we got round it as I grew older was to talk a lot. And I realised that he'd been reduced to teaching people like me because he'd damaged his fingers and couldn't play. And during those years he taught me, he had acupuncture, and he was slowly getting back again. And so that was very, very uplifting. And I liked him such a lot. He was such a nice man. And then tragically, just as he got back to form, he got cancer. And he died at the age of 61 in July 1968. And I went off to university in October that year. And it sort of was the end of my childhood. And the violin definitely got put away.
You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105.
Our aspirations wrapped up in books.
Yes, you're listening to Bookmark with a studio guest, author and illustrator Gillian McClure. Gillian, you're going to read you're going to read a whole book for us now. You can do that.
Yes, quite a short picture book text, and it's called Flood. It rained and it rained, water poured down from the sky. Out in a field, old Slodger the ox kept his head down, eyes to the ground, and close by, Fussy Hen squawked and looked this way and that for the hungry fox. I wish she'd shut up, thought old Slodger the ox. Something's coming, squawked Fussy Hen. It's the hungry fox, kick him. Oh, not again, thought old Slodger the ox, and kept his head down, eyes to the ground. Not one of them saw the flood draw near. He's going to eat me, squawked Fussy Hen, and looked this way and that, and then, stupidly, into the eyes of the hungry fox. He he held her in his stare. While old Sludge the Ox saw water swirl round his hooves. The flood was upon them with a rush and a roar. The hungry fox was swept off his feet, and Fussy Hen, freed from his stare, let out a squawk, flew up in the air, and landed on old Sludge the Ox. "Come back," barked the hungry fox, and grabbed the tail of old Sludge the Ox. "Ow!" bellowed the ox, and tried to shake off the fox, but instead it was Fussy Hen who fell into the flood. "Help!" she squawked, coming up for air. Quickly, the hungry fox stuck out his brush, and curling it round, caught Fussy Hen as she floated by. Now the fox had his hen, but he was still clinging on tight to the tail of the ox, who bellowed, "Let go!" and lifting his head, kicked out at the fox, missed, and found to his surprise he could swim. But the flood was so big, who will show me the which way to go, wondered old Sludge the Ox. He heard a squawk. Sounds like Fussy Hen, he thought. It was Fussy Hen, caught on the end in a red furry nest, looking this way and that, dodging the eyes of the hungry fox. "We're going in circles," she squawked. "Straighten up." The hungry fox looked back, tugged at the tail of old Sludge the Ox, who bellowed, "Ow!" turned, and Fussy Hen found to her surprise she could steer. "To the left, ow! To the right, ow!" And so they went on through the great flood, steered by Fussy Hen, looking this way and that from her nest at the back, until they saw land. Tired and cold, old Sludge the Ox, the hungry fox, and Fussy Hen scrambled out of the flood. But there wasn't much room on the land, so they had to squash up close. Then the rain stopped, and old Sludge the Ox thought, "Maybe, after all, I won't kill the fox." And the hungry fox thought, "Maybe, after all, I won't eat the hen." And Fussy Hen stopped squawking and stopped looking this way and that and was peaceful and quiet. They sat together and watched as the sun came out and slowly dried up all the rain and the flood drew back and there were fields again.
Thank you for that, Janelle. I was very relieved for the hen at the end of that. Listening to that and looking at descriptions of other books that you've written, Tom Finger about a little girl's journey through a snowy landscape and Zoe's Boat about a little girl and her dog. On one level, they're a story and things happen. And obviously on another level, they're about deeper things, overcoming adversity and friendship and loyalty. Yeah. How do you start? Do you start with the idea, you know, I'm going to write a story about friendship, or do you have the idea for the story and then pull out the themes from that?
Oh, I definitely don't start with thinking, oh, I'm going to do a team leadership sort of book. The ideas for the stories don't come that easily, but when they do come, they come sort of rather naturally, and they have a process of their own, and they, in a way, take me with it. And it's only at a later stage, when I have to talk to people about the books or children, I kind of realise, oh goodness, that one could be said to be all about friendship in the face of adversity or loss or whatever. Yeah,
and using animals as well, because animals bring particular qualities with them and particular images that they come loaded, I suppose. You know, a fox we think of as one thing, a chicken we think of as another thing.
Yes, they can easily represent feelings like danger, the fox eating the hen. If they were children, it wouldn't work at all, because you wouldn't be able to get these slightly dark feelings, and it would all, the health and safety would all come into it. So animals are useful.
Animals, and it's such a, in a way, it's such a shame this is radio, because I'm looking at this book now and the illustrations are absolutely beautiful, Gillian. How long did something like this book, Flood, take you to write?
They take me now the best part of a year. Mm. And this book, I went back to a style I'd done in my second book, which was to splatter and blow a lot of ink onto the page, because the whole book is very wet and splattery and watery.
Oh, lovely. Oh, well, we'll talk to you more about different styles of art. We're going to take a slight diversion now to New York. Lauren Trimble is based in New York. She's editor of digital magazine Offline. Alex Rouget spoke to her down the line, so apologies for the sound quality here, about how the magazine works. She began by asking Lauren to describe Offline.
Sure. So Offline Magazine is a digital magazine on the iOS platform, which means you can find it in newsstands on the like an iPhone or an iPad. And the idea behind it was sort of like a, I guess you could call it just a grab bag, a cultural grab bag in terms of writing. So we have fiction, nonfiction, personal essays, humor essays, like all kinds. And the goal was just to have it be as accessible and also as varied as possible. So we don't necessarily have one slant. And you can also, once you download it, you can actually listen to the audio as you're reading it. So that was one of the things we were really excited about.
And the audio is very professionally produced as well. It's not just the person reading their own article. Tell us about how you do the audio.
Oh, sure. We have an audio team. They do stuff for audible.com, and it's incredibly well produced. They actually hire actors, and if it's a piece with lots of dialogue, they'll have, you know, several actors. And they really do put their heart and soul into it. So it definitely sounds that way. It almost ends up sounding like an old-fashioned sort of radio drama.
It is fantastic to listen to. And do you hear from your readers? And what's the percentage of people reading it versus listening, or do people like to mix them up?
I think for the most part, people end up listening and then, you know, occasionally reading, because the idea originally was to sort of aim at, you know, like a young professional commuter crowd. So the idea was that you could listen to 5 stories on your way to work and it wouldn't necessarily take that much time. So I think, like, on average, you could listen to an Offline from start to finish in, like, less than 2 hours. You could, you know, in theory, do it on your commute back and to from work, so...
So that mix of nonfiction, essays, and fiction, was that really important?
Yeah, because I do think in general that rather than just have one type of magazine, I often think that literary magazines are kind of daunting to the average reader, and I kind of like the idea of having you know, literary content slipped in as well as several, like, very important to my heart, well, to me anyway, nonfiction topics, so that it was just getting as accessible as possible to as many different kinds of people as possible, and so that someone who is maybe interested in nonfiction would be exposed to fiction and vice versa.
Yeah, it's a great way to get people to read or listen to short stories, isn't it?
The short stories, I think, are my favorite part of it. I love the way that we could have, like, fairly edgy short stories with the content that was a bit more well-rounded. And again, like, the audio is so accessible in and of itself that you could just kind of listen to it and then you move on to the next thing. And I really love the format.
And what about your authors? Where do you find them?
So we have authors from pretty much all over. A lot of the authors I chose have come from connections that I had while I was getting an MA in the UK and working in the publishing industry. So it was just little tenuous connections here and there. And every so often we would approach authors cold and see if they might be interested in writing. And we found a bunch of people that way. And generally, I'm looking for authors who have very solid voices and very, like, assured voices. And so that's just been a hodgepodge of approaching people that I've always admired and approaching people that, you know, like friends in publishing or, you know, like from my MA or just in my community here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, recommend and sort of following up with them. It sort of depends on who responds, but generally it's been sort of a wonderful experience approaching these people and having conversations with them.
Yeah, you have managed to get some quite international, global content. Has that been important to you? Because obviously with this new form of publishing world, well, this new publishing world that we're all a part of now, people can access Offline magazine from anywhere. So you kind of need to make your content accessible to everybody and relevant to everybody.
I've always really liked that international aspect. I mean, I lived abroad for such a chunk of my life that I sort of felt like it was my taste, but it was also that I just liked the idea of bringing so many different kinds of people together in one, you know, sort of digital space. And that was definitely an aim when, like, something I was aiming to do on purpose when I was looking around for authors. And again, it sort of happened that way anyway, because I sort of have one foot in America and one foot in the UK. So it happened that way, but it also I think worked for the better.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the great things about the philosophy behind offline was also when it started out was the concept that, you know, digital publishing has always been quite frightening, I think, for writers. They felt like it was a threat. But what offline has been trying to do is to sort of share the love, share the profit, and make sure that the authors and the freelancers benefit as well. Tell us about the model that was originally the goal.
So the model was that everyone who subscribed to offline would pay a flat fee, which was just $1 an issue, and then, you know, 12 if you wanted to subscribe. And the idea was that just by just sort of generating a critical mass of readership, we would be able to pay the authors a direct proportion of their issue's revenue. And that kind of varies depending on the issue, but it was generally between like $80 and $200, depending on the actual issue. But it was like a chunk of something. Some of these authors are, you know, first time authors, or maybe this is their first time being published. I think that was relatively encouraging to them. And the idea too is that everyone sort of gets paid the exact same amount in the issue. And in general, like, the production costs are pretty low, and so it's not like, you know, we were getting a much larger cut of the issue's revenue than authors. And actually, it ends up being that everyone gets a pretty even proportion of the profit. And that was sort of the idea, to be as diplomatic and democratic as possible.
Yeah, is a great approach, definitely. What advice do you give people who are submitting to you? I mean, when they know that their work is going to be recorded by an actor, is there a different approach they need to take? Is it different, a specific kind of story that works particularly well for offline?
Funnily enough, I think that every time I've approached an author, I've approached them because I really love their voice. I really love the way that they write. And so I kind of approach them with a blank slate, saying, do what you want to do, write the piece that you think you would like to write, take a look at our platform, see if you think, you know, like, if you want to think about that. You don't have to, but then just kind of produce what you think is right. Generally, there's a word minimum, and the idea is just to give the author as much power as possible in terms of what they want to produce. And I think that's turned out pretty well.
No, there's some fantastic stories and issues out there. So your experience now of editing this digital magazine, do you feel hopeful for the future for these kind of publications?
I do and I don't. I definitely think that in order for publishing to stay alive as a viable industry, it needs to sort of work with its readers. And this is sort of what we were attempting to do here, is make something that kind of accessible and as easy to access as possible. You know, it's on your phone. Like, if you have 5 minutes, you can just download it from the newsstand. At the same time, though, I do think that the readership needs to be a bit more willing to pay for content, which I think is something that we're sort of coming up against now with, you know, the open access internet. And not that I'm against that fight in any way, but I think that content that's produced very thoughtfully should maybe have a price tag attached to it. So I'm not necessarily opposed well-known newspapers putting up paywalls, because I do think that it's important that authors, you know, are able to support their writing lives. So I think that it's sort of I think that the readership has a responsibility, but I also do think that the publishers have a responsibility. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's an ever-changing industry, so I guess we're going to wait and see. But I think readers have to realise it's a stamp of quality, isn't it? And that's what you're there for as the editor.
I guess that's what publishing is, right? It's sort of a filter. I think that it's important that there's like some sort of financial gain for the people who are the best and the brightest writers. And it is hard to do that, I think, given where publishing is now. But I'm hopeful that, you know, readers will realize the merit of their participation.
That's Lauren Trimble there, editor of Offline Magazine. Gillian, have you ever been tempted to write for adults?
No, I haven't. I think because I love doing pictures as well as the writing, I've always stayed at the picture book level.
And I was fascinated earlier on when you were talking about how you decide which format of art, if you like, which style to complement the story. So you're saying, you know, you used splattery images to go with the flood.
Yes.
Where do you start with something like that?
I tend not to repeat the style of the previous book, because here there's a complete new story. It needs a totally different sort of look, in a way to create the atmosphere of the story. So this goes to the technique changes. It doesn't make life easy for me because I then have to experiment a lot to try and find the right, as it were, visual language for the story, the narrative.
But it makes the book more cohesive, perhaps without the reader even realising that we've got splattery, watery pictures, that they're just getting a watery feel about a book called Flood.
Yes, I suppose it's that. Or it's the colours as well. A lot of the colours were very sort of deep blue glazes, which I got with acrylic, glazing it a bit like watercolour, yes.
And you set up your own publishing company, Playster Press. Yes. Why did you do that?
I did that in 2010 because I was finding it harder and harder to proceed with a book. My new projects weren't exactly being turned down, but there was lots of delays as my editors had to get the sales and the rights people on board. And time was slipping by. And I wanted to go back to how it all was in those first two decades with a small publisher, André Deutsch, where there was a lot of freedom, and especially freedom to work on design and work with closely with a typographic designer at the early stage. So I set up Placed Press. It wasn't easy, but now I'm really a hybrid publisher because I come under the umbrella of a publisher, Martin West, who has this organisation, authorisation, where he gets us warehousing rights and a sales agent. So it's possibly the new way of doing it.
And do you just publish your own books or have you other authors?
I do, because I'm basically an author and an illustrator, and I'm not really a publisher.
So what's next for you? What are you doing at the moment?
I'm working on another picture book. I'm just about finishing the illustrations, and I've got a bit of a deadline because Martin West is having a stand at the Bologna Book Fair, and I've got to get this book into shape, so he's got something to take. And this is a very good way of seeing not just what its reception's going to be in this country, but how overseas publishers view it.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for coming into the studio today. It's been fascinating hearing about the relationship between text and picture, something that I think, particularly as a parent, when you're going through books with children, you sometimes realise how much thought has gone into it and sometimes not. And so it's great to hear you talking about all the different processes you go through. Thank you very much. Our next show, the studio guest is Grantchester author James Runcie. We've also got interviews with the writer in residence at the Botanic Garden, that's Kate Swindlehurst, and round the world traveller Ian Packham. If you want to listen to any of our past bookmarks, then go to the Cambridge 105 website, cambridge105.fm, and they're all there right from the very beginning, many, many years ago, so you can really catch up with all the ones that you might have missed. We've got your last piece of music now, Gillian, which isn't the one that you would have preferred, but it's music from The Gadfly. Tell us about the one you'd preferred, and we'll play the London Symphony Orchestra version.
Only that the one I would have preferred was a trio, and it hit off with the viola playing, because I eventually switched to viola, and I was much, much happier not having an E string. and I tried playing this piece on it, and I'd like to dedicate it to my mother because she
was very patient by the sound of it.
Yes, I think I caused her a lot of grief.